From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a Milwaukee researcher reports some disturbing trends in the attitudes girls and young women have about sexual violence. Later, a new report shows improvement in the state of Wisconsin's air.
If you were to look at the very first year's report and see how many times those federal air quality standards had been violated, it's double digits. Now we're down to single digits.
Then, restaurants make good use of something many of us loathe, stinging nettles.
Chefs love them. They're able to get fresh ones in the spring. That's the time of year that you can get them. And people would use them in pesto. They'll use them in sauces. They'll use them in pastas.
And an artistic effort to ensure safe street crossings for Milwaukeeans. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening today. The White House this week launched a new website and urged college and university leaders around the country to step up their efforts to curb sexual violence on campus. The message comes as several high-profile colleges have seen allegations of widespread problems with sexual assault. But a Marquette University researcher says the issue is a serious one for girls much younger than college age. Heather Halavka is author of a report on the normalization of sexual violence among young girls. The study will appear in the June issue of the journal Gender and Society. Halavka, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Social and Cultural Sciences, is with us in the studio now. And we should note the obvious mature subject matter we discuss. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's talk about this study itself, and let me just start with a fairly broad question, and that is what the key issue, the key question you were hoping to address in this work was.
The key question in this work, it was part of a larger study on child sexual abuse and reporting, and when I was noticing how children and youth were disclosing sexual abuse, I was also taking notice of some of the young women not really describing or identifying their experiences as sexual harassment and abuse. And this became this study on normalizing sexual violence.
And by normalizing, you're saying this is what the girls and young women experienced, they saw as not unusual.
Not unusual at all. The key here is to really say that the young women were reporting harassment. They were describing these experiences of harassment and violence, and they weren't necessarily labeling them as such. So when they were reporting these experiences to forensic interviewers in the interviews that I saw, they were describing them as acceptable, as normal, as routine acts that are happening in their schools by young boys and men.
They were saying it wasn't a big deal.
It wasn't a big deal, in that they had to kind of accept these experiences, or they felt that they had to accept these experiences.
Right, and I guess the significant one of the issues is that they were saying it wasn't a big deal. You do make the point that some of the data might be skewed by some socioeconomic factors, that for some girls and young women, there's already a distrust of authorities in the system, which might have led them to answer questions in a way that they might not have with someone else.
Right. So they were not to say that it wasn't a big deal. What is important is to note that they did feel threatened by these experiences, and they felt fearful and knew that something was wrong. But in their interpretations of it, they were really using this cultural narratives, or what I would call really the discourse of a rape culture, to explain their experiences that they were having in these heterosexual relationships. And it could be, I mean, clearly they had a lot of mistrust of authority figures for a variety of reasons. I think that it's quite clear that some of this harassment and abuse was seen by authority figures, by people, teachers working in schools, and nothing was being done. So these young women are very smart. They know that to report these experiences or define them perhaps in sexually assaultive ways is a pretty risky endeavor. To report, they risk being disbelieved by authority figures. They risk being ostracized by their peers. and really just being shamed by their peers.
So this is a trade-off for them. They're enduring this abuse, but at the same time, they're avoiding what might be for them just as negative a consequence, which is this idea that they're not being believed or that they're being ostracized by their friends.
Absolutely. It's absolutely a trade-off.
Mm-hmm. What was the significance of the age of the people you studied? Why was it important for you to look at the issue through the lens of adolescent girls?
Yeah, the youngest I think that's what's most surprising to people is the youngest age of the young women that we're talking about here is around 10 or 11. And they're describing these experiences in ways that we've known that older women, let's say college-age women, adult women, have typically described some of their sexually abusive and harassment experiences as using these kind of traditional sexual scripts, this normalizing of male aggression as if it's natural or boys will be boys. So we've seen this in other populations, again, adults and college women, but now we're seeing it. My study really highlights that we're seeing it at very, very young ages, and we should be very concerned that this is really sowing the seeds of violence to come in their relationships.
What struck me about so many of the examples you cited is that the girls being interviewed were young, but the aggressors they described were often older and sometimes much older.
Right. We have this kind of normalization or what young women were describing as what I said was kind of everyday violence that they were experiencing. And largely this was with peers, with boys their same age on the playgrounds and buses in their schools. But then we have this other set of young women when they get a little bit older, let's say 15, 16, in some cases 14, where they were having sexual relationships with older men around 23 years old. And that's where you see this really coercive, sexually abusive behavior in which we are talking about sexual assault. We're talking about coercion and power and control dynamics happening in these relationships.
Does there also need to be parallel work done to understand how the boys are arriving at their own attitudes?
Oh, definitely. I think the study, I wanted to highlight girls' voices. In the literature and in the research, we have very little understanding of how young girls and women in general are really talking about and understanding and experiencing these type of violent behaviors. So I wanted to highlight girls' voices. But there's a lot to say about, of course, the young men in the study, young boys and older men who are perpetrating these assaults and taking zero responsibility for it. The responsibility is not being put on them by authority figures. It's not putting on them by these young women either.
Right. There's long been this focus on who's responsible for saying no, and customarily that's fallen to the women and girls.
Right. And that's how they're interpreting it, which is a great example. They're seeing themselves, again, within these traditional sexual scripts as the gatekeepers of sexual activity. So when they don't say no, there's this concept that if I say no, I just won't get raped. Like everything will be fine. When they don't say no, they have not adequately maneuvered around the natural sexual aggression that they see men as just doing. And so then they're blamed by their peers. They're blaming themselves and thus being disbelieved by authority figures, or at least they perceive that.
And well, and you also point out that the script for boys is kind of a how to get to yes mentality.
Definitely. So again, I talk about in the study this heterosexualized relationships, and it is heterosexualized. But what is normal within a heterosexual relationship is quite scary from this study, because we are talking about what we would call working a yes out or coercing someone, using these power and control dynamics to get a yes or to, you know, obtain sexual activity from a young girl.
The study notes that the idea of heterosexuality as the norm is part of this equation. How else does sexuality play into this issue?
I mean, I think we should be very concerned with how we are observing sexuality being discussed in the study and in the larger culture. We are really linking heterosexual activity with violence. We tend to link culturally in our rape culture sex and violence. And young women and young boys are picking this up. I mean, they're getting this, right? And so we shouldn't be too surprised that they're really adapting to this culture, quite rightfully so. And in another case, or what's also important to say is that they're looking at rape. We have this kind of narrative about rape and what rape is in our culture, and especially if in the last decade or so, that it's the stranger rape. It's the stranger coming out of the bushes, taking you off the streets, sexual intercourse, and that's all that rape is. So not surprisingly, this is not matching up with these young women's experiences at all, because rape is oftentimes, you know the person, they're close to you, they're your acquaintance. And in all of these cases, that was the case. None of these were stranger situations.
What do you see as the ramifications for this work in terms of how to address the issue? If we understand now that that for so many young women and girls, sexual violence is seen as the norm, what do you do to reverse that trend?
I think we need to start taking human sexuality seriously, and we really need to start educating our youth at very, very young ages. This is not a hysteria. This is what our young children are learning. And it's not difficult to think about educating them about sexual boundaries, about consent and respect for each other at very young ages, kindergarten, I would even go lower, because boundaries and a bodily autonomy is the right of every child. The child has the right to protect their body and to feel safe and secure in their body. And a lot of that is boundaries, and it's just consent. And so we're not talking about teaching children about sex. We're teaching children about consent and respect.
You mentioned that what seemed to surprise you the most was just the age at which these attitudes develop. Was there anything else that, as someone who has studied this issue or issues around this for a while, that also surprised you?
Yeah, I guess I was really surprised by the use of rape as a threat. That was really upsetting to me and surprising, this using rape to get other types of sexual activity. So in numerous situations, you know, I will rape you if you don't have oral sex with me or some other sexual activity. It was
absolutely
astonishing.
Which the girls then didn't think of necessarily as rape.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of playing into, again, this construction, this cultural construction of what rape is. So if rape is only this heterosexual type of intercourse or penetration, then anything beyond lower than that standard is not rape, which is untrue.
Well, and so you said this study is part of this larger work that you're doing on childhood sexual abuse and reporting. Where do you go from here?
Well, I have had another article that's been published in Law and Social Inquiry Journal, and that one really focused on young children's experiences and about reporting and their perceptions of law enforcement in the state. So when we talk about the differences with children and, you know, racially, socioeconomically, this is where a lot of that comes out in that study, how these young children were perceiving law enforcement and how their distrust of law enforcement really acted as barriers to reporting sexual assault to authorities. Going from here, I am also really interested in boys' experiences. So my study did include half and half gender-wise, so half boys and half girls, because I was really interested in the different gender perceptions of sexual assault for young children. So going further, I want to focus more on the young men's experiences, young boys' experiences, and some of the reasons why they're not reporting. Preliminarily, that's really about homophobia and fears of homophobia, this deep shame that we know most of the perpetrators are men, so then young boys are struggling with that a lot more than young girls are, so they're not reporting because of that. And they're also not reporting if they experience sexual assault with a woman, they don't perceive that as abusive, because in our culture, we talk about how young men should always want sex, and that's what they want. So you're lucky if you get to have a sexual experience with an older woman. And in some cases, they're much older women abusing these young boys, and they are normalizing that experience. So very similar to this study.
Well, Heather Hlavka, thank you so much for sharing the details of this and the rest of your work, and best of luck going forward.
Thank you very much.
Heather Hlavka is assistant professor in the Department of Social and Cultural Sciences at Marquette University. Her article on the normalizing of sexual violence among girls will appear in the June issue of the journal Gender and Society. A break now, and when we return, the state of the state's air quality circa 2014, how the American Lung Association sees Wisconsin when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Today, the American Lung Association releases its annual State of the Air Report. It's the 15th consecutive summary of air quality around the United States. According to the association, half of the U.S. population lives in counties that have unhealthy levels of either smog or soot. Donna Waninsky is Director of Public Policy and Communications for the Lung Association's Wisconsin chapter. She met WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz in the Menominee Valley, not far from the coal-burning power plant. Waninsky describes Wisconsin's overall report outcomes as mixed.
Wisconsin gets very good grades in some parts of the state. For example, up in northwestern Wisconsin, Ashland, they always make the top 25 list of cleanest cities. In this year's report, central Wisconsin also did very well. There were no violations, either ozone or for particle pollution, up in the area around Stevens Point, Wausau, Wisconsin Rapids. And then there are other parts of the state that are a bit more troublesome. We always have an issue up and down Lake Michigan with ozone, and that's something we've struggled with for the entire 15 years of the report.
What has the evolution been in the state of Wisconsin?
Overall, the state has dramatically improved. If you were to look at the very first year's report and see how many times those federal air quality standards had been violated, it's double digits. Now we're down to single digits. So the message of the report overall is what we're doing, the provisions in the Federal Clean Air Act are doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're bringing air pollution levels down statewide, regardless of where you are. We still have pockets that need to be addressed. Again, some areas for ozone along the state, but overall, the air quality is much improved over the past 15 years.
We're down in the Menominee Valley or on the edge of it. Is this one of the areas of nagging concern?
For ozone, we do still have too many high ozone days, yes, in Milwaukee County. On the flip side, in this report, Milwaukee County had its best grade ever for particle pollution, meaning the period of time that the report looks at, it had the fewest number of days where the particle pollution standard was violated. So even in Milwaukee County alone, it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Let's dissect the particles and the ozone a bit. I mean, talk about where that comes from.
Okay. Particle pollution, the simple term for it is soot. It's microscopic bits of dust, ash. Some of them can even form through chemical reactions. And particularly the very, very small ones, the ones that are 2.5 microns or smaller, are the ones we're concerned about because they can get way down deep into the lungs. They can bypass the lungs' natural defense mechanisms and embed themselves very deeply into the lungs. And then they can actually even get into the circulatory system through the bloodstream and impact the other organs of the body. Particle pollution will impact both the lungs but other organs as well. They can lead to heart attacks, for example, heart attacks and strokes. Ozone, on the other hand, is kind of a soup. You need a variety of ingredients for ozone to form. You need nitrogen oxides. and volatile organic compounds, but you also need heat and sunlight. So that's why ozone is a summertime pollutant. We don't see ozone forming in the winter. And the problem that we're discovering now is while we are bringing down the levels of the VOCs and the nitrogen oxides, we can't do anything about the hot weather. So you have to have that mix of all of the ingredients. So our message is we need to impact the things that we can impact, which is bringing down the pollutants, the nitrogen oxides and the VOCs, because we can't do anything about the hot, sunny days.
And those pollutants are coming from what, power plants, industry? Is there one main contributor to this?
There are probably about two or three mainstream contributors historically. The VOCs are primarily tailpipe emissions out of cars and trucks, and particularly large trucks. But the nitrogen oxides are a product of coal-fired power plants, heavy industry. So that's why we need that Federal Clean Air Act, because that's where all the regulations are in terms of reducing those emissions.
Is it the young and the, you know, is it the young and the older adults who are most at risk, or for those who might live in an area in which those levels maybe are a little better one year, not so good the next? It's compounding on people's health.
Let me address the age issue first. Primarily, the populations at risk are people either with an existing lung or heart condition, as well as the elderly and young children. And the reason for that is because young children's lungs are the last organ to fully develop in their body. It can take up to about age 12 for children's lungs to be fully developed. So if they're constantly being exposed to high ozone and particle pollution, that impairs the development of the lungs. On the other side, then we have the elderly population, even the healthy elderly population, their lung function deteriorates with age. So they're also adversely impacted. And it can be either relatively low dose exposure over longer periods of time, or it can be periodic and intermittent higher dose spikes of pollution. For example, that's why particle pollution is measured in two ways. It's measured both on a 24-hour basis, because that looks at those spikes of particle pollution, but it's also measured on a year-round basis too, because it's important to address those long-term low-dose exposures versus the short-term spike exposures.
There's a considerable effort put into these reports. This is the 15th. What realistically can be achieved by a report like this?
It's about building awareness, and it's a little bit, too, about holding the toes to the fire of the industry, the coal-fired powered plants, the big industry polluters. We believe, actually, that those federal standards aren't strict enough. They were set several years ago. We know a lot more about the science. We know a lot more about how these pollutants impact lung health and cardiovascular health, for example. And there is an enormous price that's being paid on that end. I mean, look at the medical costs associated with a heart attack or an asthma attack or some other respiratory or cardiovascular disease. So there's not just a health cost, but there's also a financial cost associated with those pollutants. Here in the Valley, the coal-fired power plant here, we're very pleased that We Energy is going to be converting that to natural gas, because it sits in a neighborhood of a lot of low-income people and children who don't have adequate health insurance. And so when they go to the emergency department for an asthma attack or a heart attack, that's a financial burden for everybody.
What do you hope the public takes from this report?
Be aware that air quality can impact your health. Ozone is odorless, colorless. It's not something you can smell. It's not something you can see. It actually burns the inside of your lung tissue. It's much like getting a sunburn on your lungs, and it can have short-term effects. It can have long-term effects. So be aware. Pay attention to the air quality index. We have a hotline that you can call to get the air quality in your county. It's 1-866-DAILY-AIR. We also have an app if you have a smartphone that you can check the daily air quality. It's the State of the Air app. It's available both for iPhones and for Android models. So there are things that you can do to protect yourself, but also do your part, I guess, would be the second thing I would say. Again, if you can use public transportation, do that. If you can avoid doing your outdoor work, like, for example, lawnmowers emit high levels of VOCs. So if you're going to cut your grass, do it early in the morning or later in the afternoon or evening when that heat is down so that the ozone levels go down. So there are little things that we can do. The trip chaining. If you drive a flex fuel vehicle, fill up with E85. Don't just burn regular gas. Flex fuel vehicles can run on E85, which has much lower pollution emissions.
Donna Waninsky is the Director of Public Policy and Communications with the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. She spoke with environmental reporter Susan Bentz about the group's 15th annual State of the Air report released just this morning. Consider all the city's restaurants. What single menu items are must-eats? We'll hear some suggestions when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke. Earlier this week, on a special all-food edition of Lake Effect, we talked about some of the trends at local restaurants and met two noteworthy restaurateurs, one with a long-standing restaurant, the other brand new. But the cover story in this month's Milwaukee Magazine says, forget about full menus, what are the must-eat single dishes at restaurants around town? That should start some people talking. Ann Christensen is dining critic and senior editor at the magazine, and she tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon the list runs the gamut from caviar to the Big Boy burger.
The background on that is that, if you grew up going to Big Boys, I did. There was one where near where I lived growing up. They had a Big Boy burger that was, a Marcus restaurant. And Marcus restaurants, or Marcus hotels, rather, is the parent company for Kilowatt at the Intercontinental Milwaukee Hotel. So, and they brought back this Big Boy burger several years ago, actually. This is not the first time I've written about it, but it's so good. And not only is it nostalgic for me and probably for a lot of other people in Milwaukee, it's just a really delicious burger. And it's on there. But the funny thing about it is, okay, so it's on their lunch menu as the burger. And on the dinner menu, you can order it as an appetizer and they cut it into pieces, which I think is so cute. You know, you can order it as an appetizer. But
toothpicks in them?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty hilarious. I just think it's a great burger. And, it's a fun one. And you're right. How could you? It's not a restaurant where you would necessarily equate those two, this burger, this restaurant. It just seems like a...
Do they replicate the actual burger from the past pretty well?
Yeah, they do. They do. Yeah.
All right. Something that and I don't know why I've never been to this restaurant, because this just seems like a place you need to go for brunch, and that is the Cafe de Plaza. They have poppy seed pancakes.
Cafe de Plaza is, again, a classic for me. It's an old Art Deco lunch counter in a kind of a hotel apartment building. Really charming place, open for lunch and brunch. I probably don't talk about this, but I love pancakes. It just happens to be one of those little things.
I never knew that about you.
I love a good pancake. Yeah, I make pancakes. I like to try different kinds. This one just, I guess, has a little different twist to it because it's a lemon pancake. It's lighter. It's really fluffy. And then it has the poppy seeds in it. And then it has the blueberry maple syrup. So it's just a little bit different. It's just a nice kind of almost, and I don't often think of pancakes as being light, but there's something sort of a light kind of, breakfast about it. But it's really delicious and kind of refreshing with the lemon, and I really enjoy it.
All right, great. Well, aside from hot dog stands, I never actually think of Milwaukee as a hot dog city. I know that I'm wrong there, but the one at Hinterland you think is one of the best.
Well, I would agree with you. I don't think of Milwaukee as a hot dog city either, but you know, you can go to Usinger's and get a hot dog made by them, right? But you don't think of Red Hot stands as being, wow, I'm going to go. I mean, Milwaukee has these great Red Hot stands. No, that just isn't something you think about. And also to think of hinterland, which is, you know, I think oftentimes thought of as somewhat of an upper echelon, kind of higher end sort of restaurant. But the fact of the matter is they kind of wear different suits. You know, there's that element. You can go to the dining room and order a $35 entree, or you can sit in the bar and have a, you know, have something off their bar menu or one of their nightly specials. And their on-staff butcher makes the hot dogs in-house. So it's a really delicious burger.
Wow.
Or I'm sorry, a really delicious hot dog.
Right.
You know, since they've been doing it, they might switch up the toppings. Right now it has this cheese sauce and the banana peppers and the fried onions on it. That's the little, you know, touch that they're putting on it. But which does not mean that they are not going to be changing it again in a few months. But it's something that you can, you know, get for a small amount of money at the bar at Hinterland. And it's again, it's not something you expect.
All right. And judging from the picture, I don't know if one should attempt eating it with their hands. I don't know. Is it a fork and knife item?
I think that a hot dog should always be eaten with your hands.
Okay. That one looks like a challenge.
Well, a lot of things are.
All right.
A lot of things in life that are worth it are.
Okay. Well, let me just ask you about something in this whole article called The Edible Milwaukee Day, which is a kind of a timeline of what you can eat throughout the whole day. Can you actually eat all these things in one day, first of all?
Yes, I think you can. I mean, I sat there and I thought, okay, what is really doable here? And this would be, again, if you decided you're going to devote an entire day to this, you're not working, you're not doing other things, but you're kind of planning your day around going to these restaurants and cafes. And in one case, there's a jerky store that you can go and pick up jerky. I think it's doable. And I intentionally did not, and our copy editor pointed this out, have a specific dinner where you sat down and had a really large meal, because there's a late night, really kind of fun late night option here of going for ramen at a new restaurant in town. So I was thinking about how you would kind of layer this on your stomach throughout the day, but I do think it's doable.
Okay. It reminds me of an article that I read recently, and this would be an interesting combination, is that in order to get your kind of base amount of frequent flyer miles onto your credit card, they suggested just going to restaurants throughout the day, maybe, and just getting, and like in the case of this article, get a smoothie or just get a jerky, you know,
right,
because it'll count towards your frequent flyer miles, you know, you'll get your minimum.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Okay. So let's get back to some of these items. I'm picking ones that I thought were a bit unusual or I've never heard of before. One of them is nettle pasta.
Yeah. You know, in fact, I ended up in a little box inside the issue, just inside that story, explaining what stinging nettles are, and that this would be, this is an ingredient you're going to start seeing right now in spring, hopefully, if you know the weather cooperates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so first of all, stinging nettle. What do you think of? You think of traipsing around in a field and they're prickly, right? And you
mm-hmm.
get this kind of rash or something like that. That's where the name comes from, stinging nettle. But the fact of the matter is that people actually eat them, and chefs love them. They come, they start, you know, they're able to get fresh ones in the spring. That's the time of year that you can get them, and people will use them in pesto, they'll use them in sauces, they'll use them in pastas. And this happens to be a situation where Ristorante Bartolotta is using it in a homemade pasta with salami and calamari. And it's, you know, it's absolutely this fresh, very spring type of dish. And that's what I liked about it, because, again, it got some kind of fresh dish into the story after we've had this kind of hellacious winter and, you know, we're starting to think about hopefully lightening up menus a little bit.
We can hope.
Yes.
All right. And is that a cream sauce based item, or is a
that particular one?
Yeah.
No. Okay. In fact, I think honestly, it's a combination of the fish, the salami, and the lemon. Kind of has sort of this very light kind of sauce on it, not heavy cream sauce at all.
Okay.
No.
All right. Something, the next item that I thought was interesting, you don't really see a lot of places, is a rabbit dish at Sanford.
Well, people have different or mixed feelings, rather, about rabbits, right? Mm-hmm. Some people just don't want to eat them,
right.
You know, because it's, some are domesticated and they have issues with that. But mm-hmm. I happen to love rabbit. I don't find it that often. And I think that's part of what drew me to this particular dish. And the fact that the chef, Justin Abrahamian, just really does this fantastic technique with it and has it almost prepares it in three different ways. So, you know, I absolutely respect people that will not eat rabbit. I just happen to think it's delicious. And if I can get it on or get it in a story, I'm happy to do that.
I just wanted to point out one more of the kind of pull-out articles, if you will, or one of your embedded pieces in the article, and that is the muffaletta decoded.
You know, the idea of doing that was from the very beginning, even before I started doing research on for this story, I was thinking about deconstructing some kind of item. I've been wanting to do that in a story for a long time. And that one, partly because it was a sandwich, I think worked really well. Well, what does it mean to deconstruct it? Well, we pulled it apart, literally. So you have the Shortino's roll, you have the cheeses, you have the various meats, and then you have the olive salad. And our art director and photographer literally deconstructed all of those pieces in a studio, and they look like they're suspended. But it was a way – the fun thing about it is a way of explaining exactly what goes into that sandwich. Yeah. And then you know. And then you see it, and it's just delicious and almost better when it's all smashed together, when you can't know all those pieces.
Well, good idea. Just a couple more items I want to have you explain to us. And something that really struck me is that you can get caviar at Harbor House. Seems like it's not something you can really get in many places anymore.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I have sort of this like passing remembrance of, you know, maybe my parents having it at dinner parties back, you know, decades ago. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed like a thing. And maybe it is coming back a little bit. But it definitely is something that is extremely, you know, it's a somewhat specific or esoteric type of taste. Some people don't really like it because there's such intense salt flavor and that kind of sea flavor from you know, when you take a bite of the caviar. So it's pretty intense. Also, if you buy really nice caviar and the whole service, it's fairly expensive to do it. You know, you might be spending $80 or something along those lines, but for a really special occasion and have it with champagne, it's kind of fantastic. So I kind of walk you through how Harbor House serves it, and they serve it with these little pancakes that are called blini, and there's creme fraiche and, you know, the raw onion. And, you know, I just sort of talk you through how you can either taste the caviar on its own, just a little bite of it, or you can, you know, assemble it on this blini and then eat it that way.
Wow, they go back to the traditional way.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. All right. One more item. I just want to get your take on the soy chorizo tostadas. I actually have had this item at Cafe Corazon, and it's really interesting. It's really good.
Well, you know, I was torn with Corazon because I think they have so many good things and things that you – I mean, they have a great burger, and some people think, well, I never knew that. But, you know, as I'm an omnivore, obviously. I eat everything. I don't spend a lot of time, you know, really – I probably don't think about vegetarian food enough. But I just think if you're a vegetarian, that's a great place to go. And I particularly like their soy chorizo. And I think if you didn't tell someone ahead of time, they might not know that it was a soy product.
Yeah.
So
really interesting.
And maybe that's the best testament for why it's worth eating.
All right. Plus, they have a really cool outdoor area.
They
When that allows, you know, when the weather allows it.
Yes, they do.
All right. So really fun article, and thank you for coming on Lake Effect.
Thank you. Thanks.
Lake Effect contributor Ann Christensen is senior editor and dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine. Her article on the city's 50 must-eats is the cover story in the May issue. She spoke with Dan Harmon. One last break, and then an effort to illustrate the need for safe intersections, the crossings, and their importance for older Milwaukeeans when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. You might be familiar with the Islands of Milwaukee, the team of artists, volunteers, older adults, care providers, and researchers seeking to create a more connected community as we age. It's a project that features a regular question of the day, which airs on Lake Effect each Monday. Over its multi-year life, Islands aims to creatively engage older adults living alone, as well as those underconnected to their community. Tomorrow and Friday, Islands is staging a series of three street performances with a simple message: remember to see and stop for pedestrians. The performers set out to illustrate that being able to navigate city sidewalks and cross streets safely is a critical piece of everybody's safety, including older adults. WUWM's Susan Bent stopped in on one of the troupe's final rehearsals.
And the light has changed. And do you performative flourish? Triangle.
Anne Basting has built a career blending performance that reaches out to and folds in older adults, people facing issues from memory loss to isolation. Right now, she leads a cluster of mostly college performers. They've assembled on a Sunday afternoon in Mitchell Hall on the UWM campus. Some play tinkling triangles. Others hold long white PVC pipes. And then there are the flag bearers and a couple of guys hoisting what resembles black plastic trays that might have been plucked from the school cafeteria. They're 4 days away from opening performance. Basting is working out the kinks. Each performance represents a crossing of exactly 20 seconds, the time they can expect a crosswalk light to allow passage in the real world. During performance, they'll actually loop in turn three highly trafficked areas on Milwaukee's south side. They head out of the building to test their timing on the street. I nab one of the banner bearers.
I'm actually a researcher here from the UK.
From University of Exeter in the UK. Researcher Carrie Schaefer specializes in community performance.
So I'm here and observing and participating.
Schaefer learned of the project and came up with grant money to travel here. She'd arrived a week earlier. What she found most compelling, Schaefer says, and what brought her across the pond, was that Basting brings performers face-to-face with community.
So the idea is that there will be some older adults who are going to be part of these.
Yeah, yeah.
And then hopefully more people will join in who are just happen to be there on that site at the time.
I don't know how many people can realistically cross the road. I think this is one of the issues because when we were rehearsing at Cudahy, there were a group of older adults and I crossed after them. And as soon as my foot touched the ground, the light turned red. Like the walk sign turned red, so I'm not sure how many people can actually participate in the performance safely. I think the most important thing is that the older adults do cross, and that, because I think the students kind of really value being the safety barriers for them, and you know, like value supporting them across the road. That's been really important for them, and that some of the what Anne calls the specials, you know, get in amongst it and listen to what the older adults have to say. You know, I hope the city engineers and the mayor and the, you know, the elected representatives can get in there and hear directly from the older adults and experience, because once you're on that crossing and in the shoes of those people, then you understand the fear and the danger. You feel that. You don't just hear it from them. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how those older adults can influence power in that way. So, yeah. But for me, that's where the performance is, where the kernel of the performance is.
Unlike researcher Carrie Schaefer, student Donald Kaczynski had to audition to get in on the crossing. He's a sophomore and a theater major at UWM.
Everybody here had to audition for it. We started rehearsals around, around January, early February. That's when we started with a couple workshops, and we actually started working out on the streets about March, April.
Kaczynski says this is more than a performance to him. He can relate to how older adults feel.
And the three streets that we're working on with in Bayview, Cudahy, and St. Francis, I actually live on that side of town, so I actually know some of the fears that these pedestrians feel. Because I walk all the time. I don't drive anywhere.
Don't you?
Nope, I do not.
So tell me, what is your role in the production?
Ah, Well, I am one of two bridges among the group. We have to stay on both sides of the crosswalk, and when we raise our bridges, that's the signal for all of our poles to guard so we can get the pedestrians through safely. It took a while to actually come up with this concept. We originally came up with a concept to link arms like a human guardrail, but that didn't really work out so well, as we found out in St. Francis.
And that's because why?
People were always trying to cut through, especially because St. Francis is always a lot of right and left turns, in that crosswalk specifically. So we had to go back to the drawing board with the objects with the bridges, the guardrails, the signs, and playful triangles as we go through the street.
Even on a Sunday afternoon, and at not a very busy intersection, drivers plow along as the performers go through their 20-second performance slots. James Hart is an observer for the first time, too, but he has a connection to the production. He's part of the national group Sojourn Theater, whose members are spread around the country. It's not the first time it has collaborated with Ann Basting. This, however, is a brand new performance experience for Hart.
I mean, I've attempted to do theater in really odd, weird spaces, but never with motor vehicles, you know, moving motor vehicles and like the not just the potential, like the actual danger. I mean, there is actual danger, so it's extremely challenging. You know, I think it's a really cool challenge in that regard. And these guys have got a really great start on it, but I feel like it needs a little something more here.
He wants the performers to have 100% more fun, and Basting couldn't agree more.
We're inviting the crossers to be part of a performance, and it should be so memorable and fun for them. Not just, like, the release of fear for the first time of crossing an intersection, which it probably will be. Like, oh my God, I don't have to worry about this car because there's this giant PVC pipe, like, blocking off the car.
She says her troupe is just now prepared to let down their guard and have some fun with the performance.
I think it's taken us this long to get over, to move beyond fear, to get to funny.
As James Hart begins to play with the troupe, drawing out the fun potential of each 20-second performance opportunity, British researcher Carrie Schaefer shares her view on the crossing's potential.
I hope that it grows from these three crossings and that it kind of spreads around the city and that people pick it up and do it themselves. So start raising sort of broader awareness. And it would be great if it went right through to getting a decent public transport system in Milwaukee. And if it broke down some of the segregation in the city. But, you know, at the moment it's just sort of, you know, I mean, people are in cars. They have to, you know, that's the only way you can kind of really get around this big city. So at least if it doesn't kind of change that in some way, can it just make people more aware that walking is also really good for you and you need to give way to walkers as a driver so that people can coexist, cars and walkers and drivers can coexist a little bit better.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bunce.
We're good.
The Crossing's performances are tomorrow at KK Logan and Russell, Friday morning at St. Francis and KK, and Friday afternoon at Packard and Ramsey. WUWM Susan Bentz visited a rehearsal for the performances, which are part of the Islands of Milwaukee project. Finally, today we've been featuring the work of some local poets during April, National Poetry Month. As the month wraps up, we hear today from Stephen Anderson, his poem called At the Oriental Theater in Milwaukee.
Something tells me that the little man in striped short sleeves and a Sears tie could really cut loose with a wild, wailing boogie-woogie on that awesome Kimball concert organ on stage down at the Oriental Theater. Instead of the take-me-out-to-the-ball-game true blue schmaltz, he's probably told to play before the previews come on. Not that there's anything patently wrong with his standard repertoire, but that magnificent organ has got to be capable of so much more, as I'm sure the man is. Watching him play, I can imagine him suddenly exploding into a Ray Charles or, hell, even a Jerry Lee Lewis rocking rendition in which he shakes the sleepy popcorn-eating, soda-swilling place up a bit. maybe even bringing those exotic moldings and fixtures to life before the main feature sparkles from the screen. And so, every time I'm sitting there waiting for the big screen fair, I'll imagine how nice it would be if he could, just once, snap out of the corral he's in, out of all that's been constrained inside, and make Hulk-like all that stuff barely breathing there.
Stephen Anderson reading at the Oriental Theater in Milwaukee. Anderson is an award-winning Milwaukee poet whose work has appeared in numerous print and online journals. He's author of several books, including the poetry collection Portals and Piers. That is the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, the French ambassador to the United States talks about shared interests in the world's hotspots and the importance of links between Wisconsin and France. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.